Well, hello. This is Bob Sutherland from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Bloomberg, Business Section of Raleigh News and Observer, Triangle Business Journal. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency. They've served our community since 1974 and can be reached at 919-781-1973. Well, we'll start off with the what news from the Wall Street Journal, little tidbits and a sentence or two regarding each subject, and then we'll come back on a few of them. The Starbucks attempted to clarify a policy toward non-paying guests after drawing an onslaught of criticism. GE agreed to merge its railroad business with Wabtec in a transaction valued at roughly $11 billion. The New York Stock Exchange is set to get its first female leader, with Operating Chief Cunningham succeeding Farley as president. Bridgewater may be back off plans to bring on former Novartis CEO Jimenez after revelations of his role in payments to Trump's lawyer. Fifth Third agreed to buy MB Financial in a mostly stock deal that didn't appear to win over the investors. Next, Ezra is buying utility and other Florida assets from Southern for $5.1 billion. Shell investors are set to urge the oil company to go beyond already ambitious plans to curb emissions. Activist investors Corvex and Icon said they are potentially interested in buying oil and gas firm Energen. A suit against Uber marks the first test of the firm's new policy relaxing forced arbitration for sex-related claims. Blackstone reached a deal to buy hotel owner LaSalle for about $3.7 billion, and Comcast's $30 billion bid for Sky is unlikely to face a British antitrust review, a government official said. Well, locally, Apple quietly seeks a second home. This is right from Raleigh. The world's two most valuable technology companies, Apple and Amazon, are shopping for cities in which to build new corporate campuses. But with one of them, you would hardly know it. Apple CEO Tim Cook this month met secretly with North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper to discuss possibly putting a major new customer service facility in the Raleigh-Durham area, so said a person familiar with the meeting. The undisclosed meeting was tucked into Mr. Cook's very public agenda, which included delivering Duke University's commencement address and taking selfies with shoppers at an Apple store. The secrecy of Apple's effort contrasts starkly with Amazon's approach. While Amazon's effort to find a second headquarters city has proceeded with the fanfare of an Olympics host city search, Apple is hunting for its newest U.S. location with the stealthy deliberateness it employs in developing a new iPhone. Since it announced plans in January for the campus to house technical support staff, Apple has said little about the effort. Mr. Cook has limited his public comments, saying during a March television interview that Apple would not be discussing its search because it doesn't believe in the beauty contest approach. And Amazon-like competition creates a case where you have one winner and a bunch of losers, he said, while Apple's process is designed to avoid putting people through a ton of work to select one city. Apple's approach has advantages, says Jay Biggins, executive manufacturing director at Biggins Lacey Shapiro. By limiting publicity, companies can exert more control over the process, avoid being overrun with outreach from cities, and focus negotiations to get more of what they want. Interestingly, Mr. Cook and one of his other top executives are both graduates of Duke University. That has got to help us. Deutsche Bank, the beleaguered German bank leader, cost reduction plans could eliminate 1 in 10 of their employees. The executives have considered plans in recent weeks to eliminate close to 10,000 jobs, or about 1 in 10 employees, as part of moves to accelerate cost cutting. That's according to people familiar with the internal bank discussions. The latest plan, with cuts that likely would extend into 2019, follows months of thorny debate over how fast and deep job losses should be at the beleaguered German Lender. The process has divided senior executives and left investors unconvinced. The bank shares have fallen by nearly a third this year and are at their lowest since a crisis of confidence hit in late 16. High-level clashes over staffing and budgets and conflicting opinions from outside investors and bank executives reveal the depth of Deutsche Bank's continuing struggles. Well, United States banks log record quarterly profit. They notched to start 2018. Newly released data show a result of the new tax law, rising interest rates, and an improving economy. The industry reported $56 billion in income for the first quarter. That's up 27.5% from a year ago, according to the FDIC. The new U.S. tax law gave banks a boost, but profits still would have been $50 billion without it, the FDIC said. The previous record was the second quarter profit of $48.1 billion. That profit surge, driven by jumps in trading revenue and lending income, help banks comfortably exceed their cost of capital for the first time in over a decade. Banks' return on equity was 11.44%, highest level since 07. That is a strong indication that banks have managed to adapt their businesses to new regulations put in place following the 2008 financial crisis. They also have been helped by consumers and businesses that at the moment are both eager to borrow and paying back their loans. Indeed, consumers and businesses are falling behind on their bank debts at lowest rate in years. U.S. banks' overall non-current loan rate fell to 1.34% in the first quarter, setting a post-crisis low, according to data. Well, speaking of the banks, Congress votes to roll back the post-crisis financial rules a decade ago, or a decade after the global financial crisis tipped the U.S. into a recession. Congress agreed on Tuesday to free thousands of small and medium-sized banks from strict rules enacted as part of the 2010 Dodd-Frank law to prevent another meltdown. In a rare demonstration of bipartisanship, the House voted 258 to 159 to approve a regulatory rollback that passed the Senate earlier this year, handing a significant victory to President Donald Trump, who has promised to do a big number on Dodd-Frank. The bill stops far short of unwinding the toughened regulatory regime put in place to prevent the nation's biggest banks from engaging in risky behavior, but represents a substantial watering down of Obama-era rules governing a large swath of the banking system. The legislation will leave fewer than 10 big banks in the U.S. subject to stricter federal oversight, and that will be freeing up thousands of banks with less than $250 billion in assets from a post-crisis crackdown that they have long complained is too onerous. The House just voted to free our economy from overregulation, Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, said in a tweet. He goes on to say Main Street banks are engines of growth, and now it will be easier for these banks to lend to smaller business and families. Well, I mentioned a minute ago that the NYSE, that's the New York Stock Exchange, was getting its first female leader. The exchange set to get its first leader in the 226-year history. Stacey Cunningham, the exchange's chief operating officer, will become the big board's 67th president. The the Intercontinental Exchange, Inc., told the Wall Street Journal. She will start a new role Friday, succeeding Thomas Farley, an ICE veteran who is leaving the Atlanta-based company. Mr. Farley will become head of the new special purpose acquisition company. Well, the Penny's CEO moves on to Lowe's. Marvin Ellison must help rejuvenate the chain. Department store turnaround is unfinished. Penny is struggling to reverse its decline, is losing its chief executive to Lowe's Incorporated, another retailer trying to fix itself. Marvin Ellison, who joined Penny in 14 and became CEO the following year, shifted the department store chain away from apparel toward appliances. Last year, he closed more than 100 stores and slashed jobs. But the company's sales have sputtered, and its once iconic stature has diminished as losses have piled up. Lowe's, meanwhile, has been searching for a new CEO to boost results at the home improvement chain, which faces pressure from an activist investor as it labors to keep pace with the rapid revenue gains at Home Depot. This is arguably the most challenging and competitive retail market that we've seen in over 50 years, Mr. Ellison told analysts last week at a conference to discuss Penny's quarterly earnings. He previously was CEO at Home Depot and Target. Well, industrials pulled stocks down in late trading. U.S. stocks slid as investors weighed the latest trade tensions between the U.S. and China. And as President Trump said his June summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may not work out. Shares waffled between small gains and losses for most of the session before turning lower in the final 90 minutes of trading. Industrial stocks, which powered Monday's rally on news the United States would suspend its efforts to apply tariffs to $150 billion in Chinese imports, were among the biggest losers. Boeing, Caterpillar were a couple of them. Mr. Trump said Tuesday he isn't satisfied with the China trade talks and separately said his planned June 12th summit with Mr. Kim may not happen, adding to the uncertainty in the market. But Trump does. He works to cut high-skilled visas and NAFTA negotiations. The Trump administration is working to slash the number of visas granted to Canadian and Mexican professionals as part of ongoing NAFTA negotiations among the three countries. U.S. Trade Rep. Robert Lighthizer is leading the push as part of President Trump's Buy American, Hire American initiative, promised during the 2016 campaign. The administration wants to limit the number of eligible professions and decrease the number of visa renewals of Treaty NAFTA visas as the countries renegotiate the 1994 trade deal. Trump, who has forced the renegotiation, has threatened to scrap it unless it addresses the U.S. trade deficit with Mexico. Well, as our truckers around the nation retire, there's a growing shortage in straining the economy. Trucking drives America's economy, but a shortage of truck drivers is putting the future of the country's economy in peril. While the shortage of over-the-road truckload drivers nationwide is now hovering around the 52,000 mark, that number could more than quadruple by 2025. That's according to Thomas Beiser, President and CEO of the Ohio Trucking Association. He goes on to say it's at a crisis level. Walking into the local retailer and having a shelf full of product is in jeopardy. The trucking industry and the economy are inextricably linked, with trucking being the primary U.S. mover of freight by tonnage and by value, according to Sean McNally, spokesman for the American Trucking Association. Approximately 71% of all freight tonnage in the country is moved by truck, which equates to more than 10 billion tons each year. Those numbers are only projected to go up as the economy grows, the population grows, we buy more stuff, he said. There's no Target or Walmart or Kroger or Wegmans or mall in America that has a rail spur piling up in the back. Consumer goods are almost exclusively delivered by truck. The industry needs to add almost 1 million new drivers by 2024 to keep up with demand. That's according to a recent ATA report. With the continued rapid growth of e-commerce, including two-day shipping, the trucking industry will find itself with even more deliveries to make and an even wider variety of types of delivery to make. Well, the results of the Fed's 2017 report on the economic well-being of U.S. households, which also explored the consequences of the opioid epidemic for the first time, found that conditions have generally improved, but many groups continue to struggle. Based on a survey of more than 12,000 people in November and December of 2017, the report released Tuesday showed that 2 in 5 Americans don't have enough savings to cover a $400 emergency expense, and 1 in 4 don't feel they are at least doing okay financially. In December, the unemployment rate was 4.1%, fell to 3.9% in April, marking the lowest level since 2000. This year's survey finds that the rising levels of employment are translating into improved financial condition for many, but not all Americans, Fed Governor Lael Brainard said in a statement. He goes on to say, we learned that about 1 in 5 adults know someone with addiction to opioids or painkillers. Brainard and her colleagues expect the unemployment rate will decline to 3.6% in 2020. That's according to their median estimate in March. They are gradually raising interest rates to guide the unemployment rate back to 4.5% over time. That's the estimate of what central bankers can call full employment, the lowest level over the longer run that still keeps inflation in check. The report's author said the findings highlight some of the problems with focusing too narrowly on measures such as the headline unemployment rate. Our understanding of full employment and how to measure is a key example, they wrote. Many workers in the survey have a full-time job with regular hours, pay raises, and good benefits. Others who are also employed describe a very different experience, fewer hours than they want to work, only a few days' notice on work schedules, and little in benefits or pay increases. Well, GE agreed to merge its railroad business with Wabtec Corporation in a deal valued at roughly $11 billion, letting GE raise some cash to fund its turnaround and shed one of its oldest operations. The transaction is the first major portfolio move in CEO John Flannery's attempt to revamp the struggling industrial conglomerate. He's in the midst of a strategic review that could result in other units being separated in what would amount to a breakup of the company. Mr. Flannery, who took over as CEO in August, has promised to update investors by the end of June with his plans for GE's 3 core units. That's aviation, healthcare, and power. He is also looking to further shrink its financial services arm. The 30-year GE veteran has said the company has no sacred cows and is seeking structures that will give each division its best access to capital to compete rather than having to fight for investment within the larger company. The transportation unit, which mostly manufactures locomotives, is one of the smaller of GE's 7 industrial units. Wabtec makes equipment for transit systems and freight railroads. Its CEO, Ray Bettler, said in an interview Monday that a downturn in locomotive demand in recent years highlighted the logic of the combination. The stars aligned, and it looked like a good opportunity for us. Well, the dollar rise hits emerging markets. A resurgent dollar is exposing weaknesses in the developing world, pushing investors to unwind long-held bets on emerging market stocks, bonds, and currencies. Ripples from the dollar's comeback have spread. Indonesia's central bank last Thursday raised rates for the first time in 4 years to arrest a drop in its currency. Hong Kong's monetary authorities last week stepped in to prop up the territory's weakening dollar. The Turkish lira, on Monday fell to fresh lows against the U.S.'s dollar, while Brazil's real is hovering around its weakest level in more than 2 years. The MSCI Emerging Markets Index, which measures stock performance, is down 10.72% from its January highs, while the J.P. Morgan Emerging Bond Index has lost 5.47% from its peak. Most new cars nowadays can be outfitted with advanced safety gear, but showroom salespeople often fail to promote the technology's benefits. As a result, drivers are missing out on features that, though costly, could possibly save their lives. For new car buyers, few new car buyers bother to try out so-called advanced driver assist systems, which include automatic braking, lane-keeping aids, and adaptive cruise control, technology proven to keep drivers safer. A recent McKinsey & Company study estimates that 70% of car shoppers are aware of such features, but only one-third of them try them out on a test drive. Shoppers lack detailed knowledge of advanced safety packages, partly because many dealers don't stock cars with these software-driven options, which can add as much as $6,000 to a vehicle's base price. Many salespeople would rather focus on selling more cars than spending time explaining technology to customers, so researchers say. That is partly because they aren't well-versed in how the new technologies work, making them reluctant to pitch customers those features. MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Age Lab, researchers recently polled salespeople at dealerships and found that just 6 of the 17 people interviewed were able to give thorough explanations of advanced safety technology. They go on to say, ultimately, it seemed to come down to lack of training, high turnover, and the expectation of more work site post-sale. Hillary Abraham, one of the study's lead authors, said on why many salespeople weren't prepared to sell safety features. Even if a customer opts for a car with the technology, the salesperson is less likely to spend any time explaining the features because financially there's nothing to gain. So for car sellers, safety is rarely first, it seems. Well, U.S.-China trade tensions represent the new norm. Headlines on trade these days are like leftover pea soup, sometimes hot, sometimes chilly, always unsatisfying. Saturday's joint Sino-U.S. statement following talks in Washington, essentially a vague call for larger Chinese purchases of U.S. goods and better intellectual property protection, was thin gruel. Still, global stocks rallied Monday following Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's statement that the United States is putting the trade war on hold, just in case the complete disarray of the U.S. side wasn't already clear. U.S. Trade Rep Robert Lighthizer, who has advocated a tough approach, put out a separate statement saying tariffs remain an important tool to protect our technology. Now, what are investors making of all of this? First, don't confuse this latest thaw with anything approaching a resolution of the core issues. Tariffs may this time be avoided, but China's leaders are well aware their best hope of joining the ranks of wealthy nations is a continued absorption, some might say stealing, of developed world technology. Leveraging low-cost labor and advanced foreign technology is one of the main ways developing countries experience so-called catch-up growth. China will therefore be open to tinkering, but unlikely to cease large-scale state support for its high-tech industries, the key complaint of U.S. hardliners. Shares of small companies are once again climbing to new highs, but that doesn't mean larger companies will follow suit. The Russell 2000 Index has gained 6.2% so far this month, much more than the S&P 500's 3.2% rise. the Dow Industrial's 3.5 rise, and the Nasdaq's 4.6. The small cap benchmark's gain on Monday took it to a fresh record, even as other indices sit well off their highs. Leadership among small caps tends to be viewed as bullish for larger companies in part because smaller companies are typically more sensitive to the United States economy. When accelerating growth lifts small caps, that should eventually lift shares of larger companies as well, so the reasoning goes. But history suggests that it isn't always the case. During the handful of times in the past four decades when the Russell has been the first of the four major indices to hit a 52-week high, after all those indices went at least 30 days without one, the record has been mixed. That's according to Jason Gepford of Sundial Capital. Mr. Gepford found that sometimes stock indices have all subsequently drifted downward, while sometimes all have gained. There have been times when the Russell continued to lead and times when it fell behind. He wrote in a note to clients that it is hard to find much of any signal when small caps lead, bullish or bearish. So where does that leave us? Well, here's an article entitled, this is from Bloomberg, How Public Pensions Can Start Healing Themselves. CalPERS, the state's huge pension fund for state employees, to juice up investment returns generated a lot of interesting feedback. It is clear that public pension funds need some help. Rather than offer specific investment recommendations, they're going to make some suggestions to help them think about what they should be considering when reviewing their own portfolios. It is important for managers and public representatives to understand they know what they don't know and what they can't possibly know. Some of the biggest mistakes in asset management come from not knowing the answers to those deceptively simple questions. Now, what do we know, or what do they know? Begin with that simple question of what any pension fund, consultant, or investment committee member knows. I'll limit it to five issues that can be answered with a high degree of confidence. Now, what's in the portfolio? Well, this should be a simple question, especially when it comes to publicly traded equities and fixed income. You can find out exactly what those holdings are. However, the increase in alternative investments such as private equity, hedge funds, and venture capital during the past few decades means that part of the portfolio are opaque. Being aware of exactly what's in the portfolio is a key to answering many other inquiries. Next one is, what are future liabilities? This usually can be answered with some confidence. You know how many people participate in your pension, the average ages, etc. Well, we only got through one and two. Maybe we can pick that up the next time. This is Bob Sutherland reading from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and can be reached by dialing 919-781-1973. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleradioservice.org.